Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the Ghibli Attack, the podcast that talks yet again about the films of the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Lieber.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm the Heron.
So join us on our second quest into the glorious world of The Boy and the Heron. Jake, Steph, welcome back. Again, to talk about The Boy and the Heron. So soon, we left some business unfinished in our standard format episode on the film because we said we wanted to go deeper, didn't want to go too deep on that first chat. Maybe people were on their first view, and this is where we can talk about things at length, having seen it a couple of times, right?
Yeah, I'm very, very excited. I mean, there's so much to this film. Michael, you and I have been kind of pootling away on our keyboards trying to kind of understand this absolute monster of a film, and it's nice to actually just chat it through because, God, there is so much to get into about it.
Yeah, I suppose first of all a bit of housekeeping. So we're recording this in the middle of December, following the opening weekend of the film in the States. So of course we're used to, when we did the old episodes of the context sections, we would talk about release and box office and all that stuff. This has been a historic release. Not only is it Hayao Miyazaki's first film in 10 years to hit cinemas, it made a whopping $12.8 million on its opening weekend, rocketed into the top spot, number one at the US box office in its opening weekend, with a bunch of firsts, I think, related to that. The first original anime production to be number one, for example. And it's well on its way to becoming the highest grossing Ghibli film at the US box office. It is now currently the highest grossing Hayao Miyazaki film, but there is one film that still has that crown. I know, Jake, you like to trot this out again.
We're going to have to edit our live show because we always had great fun revealing that Arrietty, to this day, as we would say, remains the highest grossing Ghibli film at the US box office. But give it a week, maybe two, especially over Christmas break, The Boy and the Heron is certainly going to be taking over humble Arrietty.
So Arrietty, 19.2 million. Boy and the Heron currently on 12.8 million and counting. So yeah, give it a week or two. It's been amazing. I mean, fair play to G Kids, the distributor in the States, who've really played a blinder with this. They've, in terms of the coverage, in terms of getting the hype built to the highest level. And yeah, what a result for them. And it just means we have more takes out there to digest. But I've been trying to avoid as much of that as possible because I wanted to get this podcast out and say as much as we can about what we think about this film before delving too deep. Should we delve in? Where should we start?
Well, I think we mentioned it on the last episode about the actual book, How Do You Live? And how much we thought that this was going to be an adaptation of that. So we should maybe push that aside because this is the spoiler episode. So at this point, presumably if you're listening to this, you have seen the film. And if you have by chance read that book, you know that this isn't really an adaptation of that. And you're at this point, we can really delve into this basically entirely original story that it actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose let's start at the very top. The very first thing you know about this film, if you're going into the cinema and you're buying your ticket, is the title, right? The Boy and the Heron. Is that a good title for this film?
Well, it's funny you mention it, because I had a great laugh this week when I was doing some picture research on the Studio Ghibli website with my Google Translate switched on, and you roll through all of the titles of the films, which have obviously very different translations, and very different translations depending on what software you're using. And the translation that came up for this film was, "How do you guys live?"
Yes! Which I guess is a little bit more literal.
How do you
like
do,
that.
Fellow kids? How do you live?
And it just made me think of like Jerry Seinfeld trotting out on the stage. Maybe he's got an inflatable heron under his arm and he's asking people, "So, how do you guys live?"
I don't, we can come back to a Jerry Seinfeld way of looking at this film with the "what is the deal with" as being the repeated phrase throughout this episode, maybe. But The Boy and the Heron, I know when that title was announced, people thought they're dumbing it down for an international audience. How do you live? Miyazaki himself or Tsuya Suzuki said that they wanted to have a title that really arrested the viewer and challenged them with a question. And we said how that did reflect Miyazaki's tendency to ask questions in his films, whether they were in the taglines or the themes or leaving it up to the viewers to say, "So now over to you, what do you think?" And The Boy and the Heron, is that a little bit more generic, maybe? What do we think?
I enjoy the French version of this, which is Le Garçon et le Heron. I think it's got a nice ring to it. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really bother me that much. Like, I feel like they announced it as The Boy and the Heron. They released a picture. It was a boy and a heron. So you kind of knew what you were getting. I don't think it's any more or less cryptic than How Do You Live? Just because you know there's a boy and a heron in it doesn't necessarily mean that you know what is going to happen when you go and see it, unless you've read the whole Wikipedia by now. But yeah.
I think it's helpful for the box office as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I think The Boy and the Heron is more likely to capture confused parents, grandparents over a weekend looking for something that they can occupy some children with, compared to something called How Do You Live? I don't think there are many pre-teens looking for films that have that title.
Titles with question marks. Mm. How many blockbuster films are there with question marks at the end? It could have been up there.
I mean, maybe that's a Library Cafe episode for us on the Patreon, is ranking the great films that end with question marks.
And there's one that doesn't. Who Framed Roger Rabbit doesn't have a question mark at the end, which means that probably Doctor Who is the answer to that question. Doctor Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But I think The Boy and the Heron's a good title because it does fit in well with a strain that runs throughout Hayao Miyazaki's films and Ghibli at large of just this classic children's storytelling and fable. Folk tales, where it would be, you know, the Heron and the Crane or Hedgehog in the Fog, films that have been very much inspired Miyazaki over the years, can have those very straightforward titles. I do wonder whether it shifts the focus, the key relationship being the boy and the heron. Is that really the key relationship of the film? We talked about in the previous episode about how more than many Miyazaki films, it seems to change every 20 minutes what it's about, the direction it's going. Even though it does have a stronger through line, I think, than others, this is one where you can feel the fact that he's making it up as he goes along, perhaps. And The Boy and the Heron, I love that poster as well, particularly the difference between the UK quad wide style poster and then the one sheet vertical poster where the boy and the heron's faces are getting progressively closer together, and it just looks like you're willing them to kiss in this fanfic romance version of it.
In a way, considering the success in the Western world for this one, or what we've seen in America at least, it feels like a reversal with the approach with Spirited Away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where Spirited Away was the kind of poetic, more lyrical version of that title. And it was the Japanese title that was more direct, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or similarly, there's Ponyo on the Cliff by the Sea, which is what it is in Japanese, which is thrust with the most descriptive title you can have, and they wind it all the way back to just Ponyo. But anyway, Boy and the Heron, I suppose the title doesn't necessarily give anything away any more or less than How Do You Live does. How are we going to tackle this question about what it's all about? What are our theories?
Let's work through it, I think. So I've got the kind of plot, the extended plot synopsis here, and so we can work through that, see what comes to mind. We've never done anything like this on the podcast before. We've always been a bit more elusive about those plot elements, but I think this is an opportunity for us to dive deep. I mean, the Wikipedia synopsis, this was put up within hours of the film coming out, so it's had time to rest here and be disputed. But the year is 1943, and during the Pacific War, Mahito Maki's mother, Hisako, is killed in a hospital fire in Tokyo. This is the opening of the film. And amazingly, already for me, you're seeing something new. And this was a total surprise. And we mentioned this before, the animation style during this sequence of Mahito rushing through the streets of Tokyo. And you've got that kind of warped, burning celluloid effect. Like, it's totally gripping from the start. And it takes me back to the earthquake at the start of The Wind Rises and the firebombing at the start of Grave of the Fireflies. Like, this is, I mean, for those grandparents and parents that are taking their kids to the sweet animated The Boy and the Heron film at the weekend, this is quite an intense start to proceedings.
Yeah, I think we said, like, on the non-spoilery episode that we're already seeing something so new, but seeing the influence he's taking from other films, from Takahata's films, like, into this one. So we're definitely getting, like, a lot of... It's a team effort. It's a collaboration rather than, like, Miyazaki's film alone. I think that's probably something that we'll come to as we kind of go through the plot. But I think once you have watched it and go back and think about it, like, it's there from the beginning almost, because you're seeing, like, so many other hands on this piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, just this morning at this record, I was watching or rewatching Neverending Man, the documentary that was made post the making of Wind Rises and during the making of Borrow the Caterpillar, just on the cusp of beginning production on this. And even though Miyazaki in that documentary, he doesn't have a fantastic experience with working with CGI and working with a CGI artist, there's something in it where you can see him perhaps opening up to the idea of more collaboration and different styles and different voices coming in. And even though, obviously, we've seen incredible ideas float around the creative vision of Miyazaki's films, this was like the most stylistic difference we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, and it's been mentioned in a few interviews already how Miyazaki wouldn't be touching up and correcting the animation or the key art of certain animators, and Shinya Hira, the guy who guided the opening sequence, I think was just left completely to his own devices in that. So there are some anime nerds already bristling when there are reviews out there saying Miyazaki himself trying new things by doing this. And as we've just said, he's trying new things by allowing people to do this. And maybe that's just because of how old he was. And Suzuki has talked in interviews about how Miyazaki was just left to do the storyboards, to do the story, and was not necessarily there as a consistent presence on the actual animation side, so that therefore he had properly deputized other comparatively younger animators there. The timeline is really fascinating, because this might help as we go through the art book. I know we've talked before about how he likes to make his storyboards in chunks, and how that therefore is a cart before the horse method of making films, and that can sometimes explain how the ending doesn't necessarily match up to the intentions of the beginning. this might help us go through. He created the storyboards over a series of 2 years, from September 2016 to October 2018. He did this one in 5 chunks, A, B, C, D, and E. So pretty much this whole sequence that we're talking about, and all the way up to Mahito being evacuated, is section A. And the team would be working on that while he's still, for 2 years, figuring out the rest of the film. And there's so much to come out about those original intentions, about what he was inspired by, what story he was even really telling. And I think we're still going to discover so much, because there are elements that are briefly noted or mentioned in the art book, in the storyboard book, that aren't really there in the finished work. The thing that I think about when doing all of the background reading is from that opening sequence is something he wrote in an essay about rereading How Do You Live, about how it was more the landscape of Tokyo and going back to a landscape he remembers from being very little, a blighted landscape, cities on fire. And that is completely in this opening sequence. It's nothing to do with How Do You Live, the book, but it's clearly something that was inspired in his imagination by reading that book, a sense of a city that was a city or a landscape of a country that was lost after the war, because the book was written in 1937. Something about Miyazaki, and this is something we'll come back to as we go through this film, is where is Miyazaki in all this? And I think already there's this feeling that because they've put out this statement that it's semi-autobiographical, that he is Mahito, and of course metaphorically, allegorically, he is Mahito in many ways. He's not literally so, because he was born in the 40s, he was born as the war started, in terms of the Japanese side of it, and wasn't 10 or 11, however old Mahito was at this stage of the war. And it's only very early toddler childhood age memories that he has of those final days of the war. So he's not telling an autobiographical story in that sense. He was evacuated, but he would have only been 4 or 5 at that point. He's actually probably the age of the baby we have at the end of the film, rather than the age of the protagonist. But he is also working through a lot of stuff here too. Also, something people are talking about, and it's a common theme in Miyazaki films, about dead or ailing mothers. His mum lived until the 1980s. She was very, very ill when he was a kid. She was in and out of hospital for the best part of a decade when he was a kid. But she actually lived to quite a ripe old age.
Well, I think thinking of that autobiographical sense of it, I know that in my experience talking to people that were very young during the war, or were kind of born just at the end of it, or just at once it was over, there is a kind of long tail to those events. Like, whether that is in the rebuilding of society or rations, or just the kind of the wartime living very much extended past the end of the war. And so I can see how, even if he was only very, very young and not necessarily has the memory of Mahito might have, how you just inherit those memories. And he might feel like he has those memories, even though he never lived them. Because I know that I've certainly had that in life. And there'll be certain stuff that feels so vivid because of experiencing conversations or experiencing aspects of it from that time. But God, yeah, of all the kind of wartime recreations that have been within these films, this is probably the most harrowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, like, there is kind of the emotion of something like Grave of the Fireflies drawn out over those 90 minutes is so intense, but in the moment, this is to me one of the scariest things that he's put to film. It's that intense, and I think it is through that warping of the imagery. But let's get beyond that. Let's get outside.
Beyond the first. Let's get 4 minutes or whatever it is.
Let's get out the flames. So Mahito moves out to the country with his dad. His dad works naturally as part of the war effort, building aeroplanes. What else, of course? But then remarries his wife / Mahito's mother's sister, Natsuko. What do we make of this? going out to the country, marrying the sister, all of that business.
Like, are we condoning or condemning it?
No. Like, all of this sequence. So, okay. Kind of, we're going.
Well, this is like my favourite part of the film, I think. Okay. Like, this whole, I think we said like in the last episode, this first kind of 40 minutes where you're getting this like move from city to countryside and he's settling into this kind of, I mean, it's familiar to the rest of the film because it's the real world, but it's such an unfamiliar world to Mojito because it's, you know, this big countryside house that's got lots of different elements to it. He's got this new mother that has the same face as his actual mother because it's her sister. There's a lot of kind of, I guess, like setting up of the kind of uncanny quality of the second half of the film, but it's done in the kind of real world historical drama part. And I think like the tone is handled so well in that sense. And of course, the old ladies. I love.
Yeah, this part is fabulous. And I suppose, as I said, Miyazaki himself was evacuated. Possibly the most clearly autobiographical part is the dad. He says that he designed his dad to look like his own dad. And of course, his dad also had that, worked for a company that made planes. So all of that is very close to his memories and his experiences. But already at this point, while we're seeing things different from what we've seen in the past, we are getting notes and traces of maybe what we would associate with Ghibli films and Miyazaki films. There are so many of these films that are about characters being taken out of their home comfort zone and going to the countryside, from Totoro to When Marnie Was There. Totoro, again, is a film about kids exploring a house, a huge house in the country they've never seen before, and the forests around it. And that's what this section is hitting on almost immediately. But of course, it's dialing into a great tradition of storytelling of the evacuation narrative, which is a big trend in British writing, at least after the war, which is reading up on it, because I live near Brighton, where many of the evacuation trains went from. The idea that they had to mobilise and move away so many of Britain's urban child population to keep them safe during the Blitz is something very... the scale of that project is staggering, and Miyazaki's definitely inspired by that as well. And the sorts of stories that came out of it, like Narnia, definitely that's all over this sequence too.
I think something that came to mind in this was something that we talked about with... Emily St. James when she was on the podcast, and that was about the kind of dualities that we see in the films, and that she linked over to David Lynch's work, and this mother figure, which I think in the first time that I watched the film just felt like more of an absence, and I hadn't kind of imagined the more kind of surreal, uncanny side of it. But that imagining the sister of your mum marrying your dad, and everyone keeps telling you how much she looks like her, it's a really brilliant setup in the first few minutes for how alien that space must feel, because it's not your home, but it's kind of presented as this kind of beautiful country manor, but you feel lost there. All you want to do is stay in bed, and you've escaped the war, but you've ended up in a place that's equally horrible for you, because at all times you're essentially haunted by a figure that looks exactly the same as the person that's been killed by the war.
Yeah, it's Vertigo, but for kids, right? Yeah. I saw a Japanese critic saying they were trying to dig up actual statistics for how many, there's actually a word for it, the marrying the wife of or brother of, you know, because it actually happened in the second World War, when there is so much mourning and trauma on that scale, there were some of these marriages did occur. But something that surprises me in reading the art book and some of the early texts they have in there is the term Oedipal complex comes up a lot. This is supposed to be the boy working through those almost early prepubescent feelings about loss of the mother and substitution of the mother. There's also a note very early on, and this is something that maybe was supposed to come back, is I think that who was supposed to have been stolen that we'll come to was the baby. And it was more about the boy recalibrating the family unit in that way, rather than it being a direct Oedipal mother relationship. But it all just goes into exactly what you're saying, Jake, about how it's, once again, while this is possibly the most tortured protagonist, we've said that before, that Miyazaki's had in his movies, it's yet again, like Kiki, like Chihiro, a character who is at a very important stage of the forming of their identity and having to work through something that they've never had to deal with before, mostly on their own, without their parents being able to help them through it. So that's all there in this sequence.
And I think in the setting, he does isolate himself by choice as well. Like he throws himself in a detail that I love about the bed, by the way, I should say, that he throws himself on, is the pattern on the bed, where it could be petals on a flower, it could be plane propellers. And I thought, that is so Miyazaki. is it nature? Is it warfare? It's one of the two. It's me. What else is it going to be? But he is like a ghost wandering around this place, because without him there, or imagining him not being there, it's actually quite a fun place. Like all of these old women, they seem brilliant. Like all the old men look great. The gardens look brilliant. All the different houses, a mysterious tower. It looks fantastic. But yeah, he is really struggling here. And I suppose that is when we arrive at the heron.
Yeah, the heron is such an odd creation. There's something that I've seen no one remark on yet. The first time he hears the heron speak is directly after he's just hit himself over the head with a rock. And no one said, does that explain the magical layer of this film, that he's actually experiencing some sort of concussion and fever after that? The heron is such a fantastic creation. I've used the term lording it over the estate a couple of times now as we've talked about this film. The fact that and this is the great thing about the film, is that it balances all the things we just said, the very heavy, meaningful stuff, with just how much he's being badgered and annoyed by this heron. Similarly to what you just said about how the hustle and bustle of the house is really fun. The women and the little rivalries between the old bloke and the women, and fighting over rations and cigarettes and everything. There's a lot to be entertained by and to be delighted by in this opening. But I suppose at this point, the heron is just a strange figure that's looming in the background. We've not seen its full form, right?
Yeah, and what I find strange about Mahito's reaction to the heron is he almost like instantly hates the heron, which I think
understandable.
But why, Steph? Why?
It's so creepy. Why wouldn't you? I don't know if you guys saw the around the same time that the film screened at LFF, the teen pop sensation Olivia Rodrigo had a interview in Rolling Stone where she said she's so scared of birds because no part of them is like human. They are like completely alien. Like there is nothing about them that is similar to us. So to hear one of them speak, like with no lips or anything, it's just like you just immediately feel like this visceral like fear, hatred, repulsion towards the heron. That's before he's even kind of transformed out of his little heron costume and become kind of half man, half heron. Like, I do not like it.
So you're on the side of Mahito, immediately bash the heron.
If a heron came through your window and started like squawking your name or your mother's name,
yeah,
and then left like a poo on your windowsill, like you wouldn't
multiple
be like,
poos,
I must
I
understand
think.
This.
To be fair, yeah, Steph, you are right on track there, because we saw some herons when we were in Kyoto, right? very far off. They were not near us. If one of them had flown around and landed next to us, we probably would start sharpening our own arrows. But like, because I mentioned it there, can we talk very briefly about that moment of him hitting himself over the head? Because I think that's another aspect that, because it's mostly implied, and it's some elements of it are in signage in the background as well, what happens in that sequence isn't necessarily very obvious on a first view. That, of course, he's a middle-class guy. His dad works in industry in the war effort, so he's taken care of in terms of in terms of his class and where he stands in the class system. And Miyazaki, of course, came from a pretty good, well-off background, and this feels like a reckoning with that to a certain extent. In the sense that Mihito is there in the country, he's been set up in this beautiful estate with staff waiting after him. But then he has to go to the local school, and most of his class have been conscripted into doing voluntary agricultural work in the fields. And it's a face-off with some of those kids on the way home from school where he's in a fight with them. And it's after that that the sort of the anguish and the confusion and the trauma and the grief and everything just boils over, and he strikes himself on the side of the head with that stone and draws blood, quite a lot of blood. I read an article which said it's the most blood seen in a Miyazaki movie since Princess Mononoke and the head and arm being chopped off. But actually, I'd go back to The Wind Rises and the bit where Naoko is coughing up blood. It's a very violent moment, that. And when this film got a 12A rating from the BBFC in the UK, looking at the reasons why and the sort of rating explanations, and it lists it as self-harm, and that's exactly what it is. It's a moment of self-harm in this movie, and it's clearly a working through of these conflicted emotions and feelings about your position in life and where you are. I think both times I saw it, I heard audible gasps in the cinema, and it's probably maybe not the first, but not the first, because I think the opening is also quite horrific, but it's maybe the first moment where you realise you're not in a cozy Miyazaki movie anymore when that happens.
Well, and in those moments, he's ultimately just trying to isolate himself again. But because the violence that's put upon him by his classmates isn't far enough. Mm-hmm. I think, to me, he's looking at what they've done to him. They've beaten him up, but it's not quite enough to get him out of school, to get him back in his bedroom, to get him away from everyone again. And to me, like, he's striking himself so it can be bad enough.
Right.
That the dad will say, you're not going in again, I'm having words, and you're going to stay here. And so all of this first act is all about isolation. And that's the effect that the grief has had upon him. That even though he's going to get thrown into these environments where there's all these people that could be looking after him, all these school kids that could be surrounding him, he only wants to isolate himself. And then, as the film goes on, more through nature and fantasy, he becomes constantly covered in things and submerged in things. And whether that is kind of frogs or pelicans, it's all the way is him just having to push himself into the opposite of what he wants, which is forming connection again.
And he has his meet cute with the heron. To jump off that you said there, Jake, I've got a question. What would you rather be smothered by? Pelicans, parakeets, fish guts, paper, or, I think this is your answer, Steph, frogs.
Frogs.
I think maybe parakeets, if they're going to turn back into their normal form, is my answer. The paper looks very sharp when that happens and sticky.
The paper's the scariest one, I think. I feel like maybe the frogs, I feel like you could peel them off quite easily, whereas I feel like I'd be picking pelican out of my teeth for months.
So we're into the B section now. Mm-hmm. The A section ends with him hitting himself with a rock, and the B section is the sort of face-off duel sequence with the heron, where he decides he really wants to mess up this heron, all the way up to entering the tower and that sort of showdown in that central room with the heron. This is all the B section. So this is, you know, very much the title, the English language title of the film is very apt for this whole sequence.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Ghibli version of Catch the Pigeon, right? I mean, this is quite fun. The escalating stakes of it all, like particularly after the heron like squeezes itself into the tower in a very Looney Tunes manner, and starts revealing his strange teeth and vocal qualities, and we are kind of outside of the warm reality of the country grounds. What I really like about this is the craft focus on it, and not the filmmaking craft, but the kind of curiosity about how you make a bow and arrow. This is something that as a 12-year-old boy, I was totally obsessed by. It's very Cub Scouts. It's like every week I'm going to make a bow and arrow. And of course it will be a terrible bow and arrow. And there is something quite thrilling about the fact that Mahito makes this bow and arrow and seeing all the details of the whittling of it. And then the fact that it actually works is great. And then using, as soon as he uses the heron's feather and it has that kind of tracking quality, this is a red shell of a feather in other terms. From there, they kind of, the stakes are up and you realize that kind of anything goes here and we could be on for something a bit more interesting than chasing a heron around a park.
I love, in a similar way to what we're already talking about, this is a very sort of gross Miyazaki movie, anti-cozy, the use of the sort of masticated rice as the glue when making an arrow. There's a lot of bodily fluids and fluids in general in this film, and that's, you know, we're not in sort of that idealized cozy Miyazaki mold anymore.
But this is when he reads the book, right, in this section.
When he kind of digs out a lot of books that have been left by his mother, I think.
Yeah.
And they all kind of spill to the floor, revealing a few book covers that seem to be references to other Ghibli films.
Did you have one in mind, Steph, when you say that? Because I need to go back and...
I'm pretty sure there was... Hang on, let me... There was a red turtle on the cover of one of them. Does that count?
That definitely counts.
Not if you ask G-Kids with their checklist where they leave it off.
I feel like there was a Mononoke one. There was like a deer with horns. And there was some sort of badge, which I think is a Howl's moving castle thing, maybe.
Oh, interesting.
And then obviously he picks up How Do You Live?
How do you guys live?
And how do you guys live? And then starts reading it and is very like emotionally taken with it. For me, I would have cried at the section where the author makes you read about Napoleon for like a whole chapter. I think I just skipped that in the end. But he clearly has a connection to it. I think, like, even though it's been said that, you know, there is no relation to that book in the film, I think there's like thematic connections, like you were saying about Mahito kind of hurting himself and like removing himself from conflict with the other kids, like that kind of moment of withdrawal. I feel like the boy in How Do You Live, the book, goes through a similar thing where it's kind of a moment of like, it's more like a moment of cowardice for that boy that then like kind of can't be taken back and has to be made right with the other kind of kids in his class. I feel like maybe he's connecting with that potentially.
I think that's true. Maybe it's not at the forefront of Miyazaki's mind. I think in one of the proposals or texts that's in the art book, he says, I'm only taking the title. But it is still about the relationship between a creative deep thinker of an uncle with a young boy who's experiencing a lot of stuff. Admittedly, the stakes are always higher with Mahito, and the uncle, the granduncle, is elusive and distant. And maybe that is a key difference between the book and the film. The film doesn't, even though Miyazaki has always been this almost didactic figure in his films, the granduncle doesn't have all the answers, and actually he's the one that's over-invested in Mahito being this true-hearted soul, and it's Mihito having to understand on this journey of self-discovery that no, he's not, and get a bit of perspective that way rather than reading a 30-page chapter written by his uncle, as in the novel, which has its real moments. I think that the sequence you alluded to there, Steph, which is where Copper is at school and his mates are having a snowball fight with older kids, and he doesn't rise to the challenge and help his friends.
Yeah,
I could really see that working beautifully as a little moment in a movie. And then he has to then reckon with the consequences when school gets involved and all this stuff, and apologies and going to see his friends and making up and all that. I think that there are some links there, but as you say, the stakes are higher. And of course, Copper doesn't go into a magical tower to track down his uncle who read too many books and went insane. I believe as well.
Loose connections.
Across the Google Translate vortex, I was reading as well some statements from Miyazaki, which says that the books were important. The granduncle's books, which are all over the first two, this particular sequence, the tunnel going into the tower is lined with books, and they say that line, he read too many books and went mad. When in the end, really, books aren't that important later on. And that's something that has a connection with the book I mentioned in the previous episode, the John Connolly book, The Book of Lost Things, which is very much about libraries and books and the magic of fiction and stories, which isn't so much in this the later sections. But what we do have is this showdown in the this strange and beautiful. I called it an antechamber in my notes, but what would this sort of circular room?
Well, you've skipped it, so let's work through. So after reading the book, that's when he sees Natsuko, his mother/mother's sister, disappear into the woods.
Mother aunt.
and she's pregnant, and so she disappears, and Mihito and one of the maids, Kiriko, they head towards the tower in the hopes of finding her. And there's this tunnel. And so the tunnel that's engraved with words from Dante's Inferno in Latin. And so this is kind of definitely kind of one reading that you can approach with is that this is kind of some descent into hell, which it isn't in some ways, and I think the heron is a Virgil in some ways of being this guiding figure that takes you through all these different realms. But it's when they get on the other side of the tunnel that you, of course, Michael, you mentioned the tunnel is lined with books, but it's when you get on the other side of the door that the heron comes to life after peeling itself away from the wall, where it's a drawing. So it is this drawing come to life, traveling through this corridor of stories, and then it's taking this young boy into this journey to try and understand life and death, which I love. So, I mean, there's so much going on there, but I mean, in a way, that's like the heron is animation. Like, if we're viewing Mihito as Miyazaki, the heron is a still image come to life. And that's going to be this journey that he goes on. It's like, are you ultimately going to stay in this world and become the granduncle? And I think we get to it down the line, but I think maybe that's the decision that Miyazaki made in his actual life. And that there was this lure of the heron and he was the boy.
And I think
the galaxy brain takes a beginning.
This is amazing. Let's keep going. I think the heron as animation is a fantastic point to make, because the heron as Ponyo in previous film shows the potential of animation to have a character that can change and warp and transform based on the moments and mood of a film. And when we first, when he first sort of regurgitates the man inside the heron, it's very similar to the sequences where you had three or four different versions of Ponyo between fish and girl. But on a whole new upsetting, disquieting, gross sort of level. And there's a moment where the heron is quite scary because it says, you know, I will have you, you know, when he lures Mahito to the body of the figure of his mother and it melts away, this melting figure is very terrifying, looks like something out of a horror manga or anime series, but then very quickly turns into something slapstick and knockabout and funny. And it's almost showing how there are so many moments. We're getting to the moment where it gets a bit more episodic, perhaps, but it feels like every sequence is just a masterclass from Miyazaki and then the animators he's handed this over to, showing how at the turn of these handbrake turns can happen stylistically, tonally, but you are so involved in the magic of the film and you believe the world and the animation that anything is possible. That you go along with it. And it's so great when you mentioned it's like a Looney Tunes or a Tex Avery creation. When the heron has the arrow through his beak and then gets the beak has the hole in it so he can't achieve full magical heron form. So he's like Roadrunner or Wile E. Coyote. You said catch the pigeon, didn't you, Jake? Where it's all knockabout cartoony stuff, possibly the most cartoony we've had in a Miyazaki movie, certainly
since Castle Cagliostro.
Yeah, exactly. You know, where he's flapping those wings as hard as he can to stop himself from falling down the canyon, or in this case the central tower room. It's just incredible, really fun stuff, and this is where it starts showing how funny this film can be, and it is very funny.
It is very funny. Before we move on, I do want to say, like, encountering the kind of mirage of the mother that turns into this goop in this, like, beautiful, almost Roman hall that's just bathed in light. It did make me think of Magnetic Robes.
Oh, yeah. That's
the Satoshi Kon short, where it's like there is something, like, beautiful but terrifying about it. And that idea of reality disintegrating around you in the chamber of something so stunning. I love this strange sequence because this is where we first kind of have to accept that the geography of the tower and the entire rest of the film makes no sense, which I love. From here on out, no rules apply. And I know in Spirited Away, the bathhouse, it's not like we have a clean map of how the bathhouse works, but even in such a strange space like that, you do have a sense of there is, in some abstract way, a structure here.
Yeah.
But yeah, because in Spirited Away, you have like the lifts, you know, you go down to go down, you go up to go up. Like there's clearly like there's physics at work. But in this, you see, you know, the granduncle right at the top of the tower saying, come up to me, and then they go down through the floor. So you're immediately kind of all which ways about, like not really knowing which way is up or down.
And that's a way that this is very much more in the direction of Alice in Wonderland than maybe the films that have previously been touted as Miyazaki's version of Alice in Wonderland, because it is a bit more of a surreal space. And it's very subtly not so obviously a huge departure for him, because Miyazaki very much came out of a school of a kind of animated realism where characters had consistent shapes or consistent motives. The worlds around them were very well detailed and consistent. And as you say, even though they can be magical or fantasy based, you can still understand the basic, some of the basic rules of the worlds around them. That was all thought out and thought through. And in this one, it feels a bit more like anything goes. And this art style can change from moment to moment as well.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation.
Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I mean, I feel like now that we're in the tower and it is getting more episodic, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. This, for me, when we were watching, this was where I started to think a bit more thematically, like, okay, obviously I'm watching a boy dig a hole in a ship, but there's earth underneath, or I'm watching some amazing butter and jam on bread being spread to, like, unreal proportions. But, like, what does this all mean as a whole within the film? So maybe, I don't know how you guys felt about this section, if that was like where your mind went, or if you were just like along for the ride.
This is where we're introduced to Kiriko being one of the old women.
Yes.
Who joins him on his journey, is transformed from one of the older women to the younger women. It's another bit of duplication going on. It's a Yubaba and Zeniba again, or mother and sister again. And really interesting, because it poses more questions than it answers. But she's brilliant. She's like something out of Princess Mononoke, really.
Like, oh, she gave me like how vibes.
Oh, interesting.
I guess, like, because she's got a magic wand.
Yeah, she's got a cool little apartment that's quite dirty, but it's got lots of little cool little glass bottles in it. And yeah, that was
not to go back to the sort of timeline thing, but what really made this whole chunk of the film make a bit more sense to me is that this is Block C and Block D, basically. Block C is the ship graveyards, the pelicans, the warawara, all that stuff. And then D is parakeets, Himi, up to going into the tower. So this is almost like he's set things up and he's just going to jam for a while before then having to figure out in part E, October 2018, how to figure it all out again. So, yeah, this is, I think we mentioned that it gets very episodic, but this is just like, again, masterclass after masterclass. I think we said about how, you know, we're going to, maybe this is skipping ahead, but the Warawara's section. This is like, I know, probably not intentionally, but we didn't know these creatures existed for an hour plus of this film. And really, they're only in it for 15 minutes at most. But goddamn, they're so iconic immediately. Yeah. And it's almost like, watch me. I'm going to create a whole incredibly cute thing you've never seen before. You're going to be so invested in them. There's some lore attached to them. You're going to see the most beautiful thing you've ever seen with them. This beautiful moonlit night of them rising up into the sky, and they're going to be the souls of born children. And then we're going to introduce some peril, and you're going to, once again, really hate birds because of the mastery of this film. And it's just, it's an ebb and flow. It's almost like a short film in its own right. You're introduced to these characters. It's beautiful, horrifying. And then you also meet the noble pelican afterwards, who tells you that it's actually much more complicated than what you've just watched. It's not just that pelicans are eating warawaras for fun. It's because they're actually starved within this world. And that's the horrible cycle that they're in. In the in this sort of food chain that's been created by a human hand, which is, again, harking back to Miyazaki's pet themes of how we have created a decaying society.
I was reading a bit about pelicans, and because there are... I was reading about pelicans.
How to kill a pelican.
Well, I think, Michael, you said a bit earlier about, like, the kind of mother figure being quite present in the film and the Oedipal thing, and the Warawara actually, like, they go up to the surface to be born as children, right? That's what they are. Correct?
So they are...
Like eggs?
Sperms.
Or sperms, who knows? But we're inside this tower where Mahito's gone to look for his mother, old mother and new mother. He's inside this tower. He's seeing the Warawara, who are children to be, and then pelicans are eating them. I feel like it's another kind of thing of the world being turned on its head, because apparently pelicans, in kind of other symbolism, they're like sacrificial parent figures. So there's a lot of kind of imagery, like Christian imagery, medieval imagery of pelicans kind of feeding their children with their own blood. So they will like bite them, draw blood of themselves to like feed their children. But then in this world, they're like eating the little Warawara children. So I have no idea what that says about this film, but I know there's a lot of kind of mother figure imagery and kind of strange stuff going on. I feel like, I don't know, maybe we're getting into the territory of just throwing out some stuff. But there's definitely like something going on with, because, so we have, a heron, a pelican, some parakeets. I feel like they're not random choices of bird, unless Miyazaki just has particular hatred towards those three types of bird. So I just thought it was interesting that that is what they have been known to symbolise. Yeah.
Do we think there's a sequence on the cutting room floor with storks involved? Like, what does Miyazaki think of the opening of Dumbo?
Maybe.
I think the Warawaras is my favourite sequence in the film. I think it's like
so
watching Miyazaki just do the pillars of creation. And like, to be honest, I'm not a religious man, but I'll take that as my Bible. Like, it's amazing. I absolutely adore it. But I love, because it looks so kind of ethereal and magical, watching them ascend into the sky, these little kind of marshmallows with arms. And I know you said, like, what an incredible creation by Miyazaki, Michael. But these are the adipose from Doctor Who.
Oh, I saw some of this. I don't watch Doctor Who, so I think I just saw some screenshots, so I didn't realise that.
Well, I can see you've got your computer open. Just have a quick Google of what an adipose looks like. I'll be waiting. I'll be here. If you haven't seen what an adipose looks like...
Spell it for me.
A-D-I-P-O-S-E.
But not the tissue that's in the human body.
No.
Which might have actually been the body fat tissue, called the adipose tissue, which might have actually been could have been what inspired Miyazaki. They could have just been inspired by the same thing. I can see this. That's more like an actual walking marshmallow. Whereas what I love about the Warawara is that it feels like the, particularly since we did the kids' book and since I've had Ivo drawing with Ivo, the great thing about Totoro, the great thing about Ponyo, the great thing about the Soot Sprites is that these are character designs that kids can draw. And I think the Warawara is an amazing addition to that, because really you just have to draw a circle with a smiley face in the middle and you can draw lots of them. The adipose, I can see some link there.
Oh, I can't imagine Miyazaki has watched Doctor Who. If he has, lovely. But I think, like, even before this, just thinking of, like, elements tying this back to things that we've seen before in his work, like Kariko's ship and the catching of the fish, like, that feels like a mixture of Future Boy Conan and Little North Prince. Like, we're almost like kind of going back and playing them in a new way. And it's really something to behold, like the pulling the fish open, like how to pair a giant fish. Amazing scene.
That's another shot, not to ever suggest that they're actually copying you know, storyboards from or key art from previous films, but there's the bit where Mahito is poised over the fish with the knife to gut it, and it looks like San in Princess Mononoke with the sword.
Oh, that's a
there's
great
like one
thought.
Moment
yeah.
where that particular shot looks exactly like that, but it's a great moment of kids learning a trade or a craft or something that's important in life, but done so to such a gross level.
Oh yeah, just like the amount of like the infinite guts within this fish that just spill out and cover the screen. It's so gross. I love it.
I was wondering if you guys noticed any other shots that looked like they were drawing on some of the other films, just because I had a couple that just made me think like, oh, that looks like a shot that I remember from Princess Mononoke or whatever. There's one shot to me where there's a shot of the heron walking on the roof of the house before they go into the tower, and you just see his feet. Mm. And it looks exactly like the forest, Spirit of the Forest from Princess Mononoke. There's a shot where he's walking and all the flowers are kind of blooming and dying. It's just a very similar shot. But yeah, I was just thinking about the use of that stuff and the reference to kind of other films of Studio Ghibli that have obviously built up to Miyazaki being able to make this film.
Well, I think that's what makes this perhaps even more autobiographical than The Wind Rises. Like, there feels like there are more semi-direct or direct references like that. I think Kuriko on the boat is intentionally styled like Future Boy Conan.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much on purpose. And I think that's why I think it's like this is more clearly a wrestling with the career that he took, the lifetime that he spent making these stories, and whether descending into this world for an entire lifetime was worth it.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is complicated by the fact that some of the signatures we see on screen may be Miyazaki, maybe in his storyboards, but they could also be the fact that to make this film, they brought back all the key players. Mm. So many of the key animators who've been working on so many of his features are brought back, and maybe this is their signature that's appearing again or after all these years. And I'd love to delve into the storyboard book. My budget didn't stretch far enough to, because CD Japan or wherever I got was like £25 per book in shipping, so I didn't stretch that far. But the art book is gorgeous. But this whole sequence just feels like, in a similar way to Spirited Away, the opening up of the brain, so many beautiful images and moments and ideas from that mysterious golden gate that he sees, all the way to the house that's in a boat that is festooned with nature, which feels almost like the sea-bound equivalent of Castle in the Sky as well in that moment.
But it's also in bloody Shuna's Journey. Like, good in point, Shuna's then. Journey, Shuna comes across a ship in the desert, but the ship is made of wood and bricks. Like, he cannot resist going back to the well. And if the well's water is that good, then why not? But, okay, let's move on from the Warawaras, as much as we don't want to. So that's where we get more of an idea of the granduncle. Granduncle is teased, but we'll come back to him later. And here, Mahito, Himi, who we haven't met yet, is introduced. She's the young woman with magical powers who seems to appear out of flame and then disappear again at helpful or unhelpful moments. Did we get who Himi was straight away? I didn't.
I don't think it was necessarily very clear. She makes the reference about there are references in the script to sisters who had disappeared and come back and things like that. So you could probably pick it up as you go. Not on my first view, I didn't.
Yeah, not at first sighting, but I think before she reveals who she is, kind of right at the end, you have worked out by then.
Yeah. I mean, Steph, you've now got me thinking of like all the like different kind of connections that I've been making whilst watching this and going back over things, because like Himi's kind of dressed like Sophie in Howl and she appears in The Flame, which is a thing that happens in the Nausicaä manga as well, almost kind of laid out exactly the same. But she becomes this kind of assistant on this journey. But you've got Mahito and Himi and the heron, who has been absent for a bit but then comes back in again. There's a lot of that. People kind of get subbed in and subbed out.
When he goes out, I breathe a sigh of relief. And when he comes back, I'm annoyed.
There are so many like moments in this sequence that are like great moments, particularly watching them in the cinema, and very funny moments. So before he meets Himi is where he goes into that building. Well, you know, even before that is when he reunites with the heron. And he whittles down the little cork stopper for the beak, and it's almost a Hollywood comedy jump cut type gag, where he's hammering in, and the stopper, and then similarly when they go into the that house that's been vacated, and all of the parakeets are there. It's a very funny sequence, and in a way that I think both times we watched it, the audiences were quite surprised there were gags like this in this film that are so dark and, I guess, goofy in some ways, because the parakeets are terrifying but goofy. When we first meet them, they're there welcoming him in sort of broken language or awkward mannerisms, and then you see from a sort of shot from a certain angle that what this parade, this like procession of parakeets that welcome into the house, have like cutlery and plates behind their back ready to devour him. Really funny, that stuff. And before we then go to meet Himi,
they have an almost penguin from The Wrong Trousers quality to them.
Yeah,
just so good. So go on.
Well, I think like they reminded me, going back to Alice in Wonderland, of the playing cards, as these kind of these like comically figured henchmen that kind of roam these grounds, being a bit silly but also a bit violent. But I love their abode, because they are somehow also living within the tower, but the tower seems to have rooms that just expand and expand and expand, and there's a kitchen. There seems to be some kind of bar where the parakeets hang out.
I'd love to go to the parakeet bar.
But this is all within the tower, which from the outside seems to be at best 10 meters wide, but all of this is happening within there.
I think it feels like, I guess it depends what direction you think Mahito and his crew are going, right? Like whether they're going up or down or in, because it kind of feels like they're going in a spiral, and then whatever new level they're on, there are like similar visual motifs, but they've changed slightly. Like there's stuff when he's at that kind of golden gate with all the pelicans around him that reappear in the kind of delivery room in that kind of big scene with his aunt. And then, yeah, there's like so much kind of, Michael, you said like, Miyazaki's like jamming for this bit, but he's kind of returning to these like visual kind of pointers to kind of ground himself in places. But then, yeah, he could be going further in, and then with each point he goes into the tower, there's like a new layer of weird fantasy getting further from reality. I don't know. It's a weird black hole.
I love all of this. This is like, this is so up my street. I love him just making every threshold of this space an opportunity to do something new and something that we haven't seen before. Like there is that room that is almost just entirely bathed in light, that has these square doors where you walk from one side to the other and a doorway can appear at any moment in any location. That's brilliant. But going back to the horror that we mentioned earlier, that delivery room you mentioned, Steph, like where he stumbles upon Natsuko, who looks like she's ready to give birth. But this is horrifying, where like the birth of her child transforms into like the burning of Tokyo again. and the bandages on her transform into the bandages that would have been draped around his mother's flesh, which then wrap around him and kind of turn him into some kind of Boris Karloff mummy type figure. And that's just this little aside to the narrative that doesn't, it kind of just exists in some kind of dream space. But there is so many moments like that that just add up, emotionally speaking.
Yeah, I'll admit this is the point where I lost the track of the story, but was very much driven along by the imagery and the real raw emotion. And it's something that is hard to translate in the subtitles, but what breaks through in that moment is when he starts, he recognises that it's not his mother, it's Natsuko, of course, and he starts calling her Natsuko... Kasan, Natsuko Kasan, meaning Natsuko mother, sort of blending those two words together, and starts to recognise in her his mother, but also his new mother, and his responsibility towards her and the child. And it's a very profound emotional moment. To go back to something, Steph, you know, you say the moments that make us think of other moments.
Mm.
It's Spirited Away, isn't it, with all the paper, little paper guys?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
So that's, again, something very similar here, but in a much more terrifying way and resonant way, seeing what we've seen before and the milieu this is in. Mm. But
this is also where, like, just after this, we kind of get some logic inferred into the whole thing that doesn't really add up, where Himi is explained to have been Hisako, his mum, who disappeared into the tower, which was actually a meteorite that landed on the grounds of the building, and she went into it for a year and then came out, but she hadn't aged a day, which is very Narnia.
It's the lore of the world. This is what I sort of talked about on the previous episode, where it's better to not think that this is a 1,000-page fantasy novel where the lore is completely laid out and explained. It's better to go on the vibes because, the tower is, of course, a place that traverses space, but it is also mainly a time-travelling. All those doors are doors to different times, rather than necessarily different places around the universe or multiverse or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Because it's around this point as well where we first go through one of those doors, because Himi and... That almost like Star Wars infiltrating the Death Star sequence where they're going through all the corridors and there's some parakeets coming their way, so they've got to go through a door, but the door is a portal back into the real world, the present day, the 1940s present day. And we have that amazing moment of the... action hero dad.
But it's silly.
Out to avenge his son.
Yeah, it's silly cartoony stuff again. They're kind of the infinite corridor and people bouncing in and out of different doorways. That's like Benny Hill. Like, we've seen that in so many other cartoons as well.
Is that the point where the biggest laugh line in the movie is, where it's Mahito turned into a budgie?
Yeah.
Because he's like striding up and he's got his samurai sword in his shoved into his belt, and he sees them and they're marching towards them, and then there's that flush of birds turning into their sort of normal form. Then my son turned into a budgie. You must love this stuff, Jake, because it's almost Spielberg-y Indiana Jones, because they're both then imprisoned and there has to be a breakout.
Suddenly got a kind of a very clear kind of baddie to go up against in the parakeet king. And all of the parakeets that just kind of profess their undying love for this parakeet king, I find so funny. They like anything to do with the parakeets is hilarious. But like, this is kind of where we get right really into the strange end of things, where things are both very philosophical and very action heavy at the same time, where the parakeet king is kind of going to make a deal with the grand uncle that's wrapped up with Himi and Mahito that are all part of it, whilst the tower itself seems to be crumbling.
Well, this is the transition between the D&E sections, which is where it suddenly locks into a bit of plot where Mahito wakes up in the dungeon. You've got the amazing heron disguised as a parakeet stuff. And it is all very Spielbergy, and we're introduced to this fascist state of the parakeets. Very interesting that we've had Guillermo del Toro, who's very inspired by Miyazaki, and then now Miyazaki make films, animated films in the last couple of years, where there is a very clear Italian fascist kind of allegory within the film, with his version of Pinocchio very much being Mussolini inspired. And then, yeah, that all seems to be getting us to the stage where it's the E section, where it goes cosmic and big meaning, big theories, big thoughts, the showdown or the meeting with the grand uncle, the going behind the curtain and seeing the Wizard of Oz figure, which is a galaxy brain moment, I suppose.
It's so good.
This is where it's like
you say, you joke about he goes galaxy brain. They do a Stargate sequence.
It goes like, Tree of Life, Terrence Malick, right? Yeah. It's so like even Hesaishi in the music. That's where he fully goes Philip Glass, swirling strings, arpeggios to the heavens kind of stuff, which is so wonderful. I love his score. We can do another 2 hours on the score at some point.
Oh man, I absolutely adore it from here. It's like none of it makes any sense, but it's like so satisfying somehow. It like the last 10 minutes of the best Christopher Nolan films, where it's just like these waves and waves of glory over and over again, because it's setting stuff up that particularly for us, because we live in this world of this studio so much and we talk about it so much, like all of a sudden the grand uncle, who has spent his life living within a fantasy world building an artistic structure and over again, says that only someone who has a blood relation of him can like maintain this world. It's almost too easy.
Well, yeah, this is where we have the several competing, conflicting, overlapping explanations or theories about who's who, what does this all mean? And I must say, on my first view, the thing that struck me the strongest and touched me really is that feeling of what he said about this being a story for his grandson, and it all hinges on a moment where a kid, his probably his grandson's age, is going up to an old bloke who's there in his study doing something the kid doesn't really understand and says, "What do you do all day, granddad?" And it just feels like there's a beautiful moment where it's Miyazaki trying to explain what he does all day to a young kid, and it's like, in the simplest sense, it's like literally getting child building blocks and saying, every day I've got to kind of like build these up to a tower and see whether they, you know, withstand gravity for a day. And if they do, then I've done a good job. If not, it's all falls apart. And it feels like in some ways it's so cosmic. And as you say, Jake, and it's very Christopher Nolan, Interstellar, big thoughts, but it's also at the heart of it a very simple explanation of the creative process, because how do you explain to somebody who doesn't understand the notions of animation or storytelling or writing the building? You use building blocks, and yeah, it's the simple thing of, does it hold water, does it stand up?
Those blocks I love, because I think I can't remember who says it, but there's something along the lines of like referring to those stones that he keeps making into the statues. Those stones can be statues, although it can be gravestones. And that's kind of what he's wrestling with here in terms of legacy, is what am I making in life? What does my life amount to? Does it amount to a piece of art, or does it just amount to my death? And does it amount to a gravestone? Which is amazing. Like this is a finale of an animated film that's currently the number one film in America.
Because this is where we talked about this when we talked about The Wind Rises way back when, how that is a big apologia, a reckoning, a mea culpa for a life dedicated to his craft, where his relationships with his loved ones maybe had to be sacrificed for that. And there was this sense that you have your moment in the sun, your moment of genius, and you have to dedicate yourself to that. And maybe there'll be people you lose along the way. And that's back here, right? Because there is a reading where Miyazaki is... This is Miyazaki at both the beginning and the end of his career. This is Miyazaki, the 11-year-old, who's been inspired by watching films, reading manga, thinking this could be a life for him. And it's Miyazaki in his 80s saying, was it all worth it? And is there anything... Have I actually created anything that's really lasting, that can exist beyond me, that really means anything? It makes me think of... I think this has been posted. This is by no means a unique thought, but it makes me think a lot about the bit that's sometimes used as a meme in The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, where Miyazaki's asked, are you worried about the studio's future? And he says, the future is clear. It's going to fall apart. I can already see it. What's the point in worrying? It's inevitable. Ghibli is just a random name I got from an airplane. It's only a name. And some of that is verbatim in the script, said by the granduncle. Like, you know, it's all going to fall apart. What's, you know, it's inevitable.
But what I like about the film's approach to that idea is in Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, he says that in a kind of nihilistic, offhand way. And that people will imagine him as this grumpy granduncle. But in The Boy and the Heron, when the decision is made to destroy the tower, to destroy the world, I think the granduncle is pleased.
Relieved.
Yeah. And I think that's the right decision, or at least within, for the characters, that's the right decision to make. And I love that, because it feels like there is so much weight taken off of anyone that would come after him, particularly Goro, I'm thinking of as well, that there's this almost acknowledgement that there is too much surrounding me as a filmmaker and this studio, and that to preserve the legacy of the studio, the best thing to actually do is to almost put it away now, to destroy it. And let something else be built instead by other people, which is a strange thing to say as people that built their careers around talking about this studio. But I really think that's such a bold thing to suggest at the end of the film. But I think there's some truth to it too.
Yeah. And it's very fortuitous that the film comes out as they do sell the studio to a partner, and it is almost like, okay, over to you. We're not going to try and keep this as a going concern with the new generation and foist it on the shoulders of Yonabayashi or Goro or all of these people we talk about. It's really fascinating. It's really hard not to get, as we have got so deep into the autobiographical auteur theory stuff here. And Jake, I'm thinking back to how you say that you think that Miyazaki's all three, the boy, the heron, and the granduncle, because, yeah, sure, the memes say that he's the granduncle. He's saying he was once Mahito. And he's also the heron because he's just shown you a really fun ride as you're going through all this heavy stuff. He's also puckish and silly and a bit scary and all these things that the heron is, at the same time as he is posing all these questions that he never answers in his films. He likes to end things on a, over to you guys, how will you live? How do you live? Whilst also still having the wonder of animation at the heart of it.
Well, and it's only in animation, in the way that he tells stories, that he can have this dialogue. Because in reality, he can't have a conversation with the 12-year-old version of himself. But this is the way that he can, and that he can pass on that conversation to his grandchildren and to other grandchildren out there. And this feels like a way of communicating to that young generation that are directly related to him, see him as a grandfather, about what happens to me when I die, what happens to my work when I die, but also the wider Ghibli community. Like, it feels like a message to them, to us as fans as well. Like, it's not just the tower that's closing or being destroyed. It's the studio, it's a career, and the end of that career is something to be celebrated because of the beauty that came from within that tower.
And this is what I love about a film that's misshapen and weird, because if this was written Hollywood style, Pixar style, where you've got several story editors and a story committee and council making sure this is thematically perfect and structurally pure. You wouldn't be able to have these odd corners and gaps where we fill them with meaning that are, that engage you in ways. You lean in, you have to figure things out for yourself. And that's why I talk about this when people ask about it. I say you've got to wrestle with it in a way that you would when it's a great work from any other great filmmaker. It's not just a packaged Ghibli, cozy Ghibli masterpiece where it's going to tell you, here's your nice character, here's your nice food moment, here's the thing you're going to get as a tattoo, here's the merchandise.
It does admittedly have all four of those things.
I mean, that's the great thing about Ghibli, right? He's always been able to do that while making films that don't have endings. Because this film doesn't really have it has a massive, big thematic climax, and then it sort of peters out in that final scene. And I know people have been frustrated by how it ends specifically. I think this is much better than Spirited Away in that sense, how it ends. But what do we think about Suzuki's read of this film? So, of course, it came out in Japan with zero marketing. They had the poster, the title. And so I've been theorizing in many ways about and keeping up with this international release. And the international release, particularly the English language release, is the first time that Toshio Suzuki has really been able to talk about it properly with press. So he's not been able to imprint his reading or use his marketing wizardry on it. And the big quote he's been giving to almost every English language outlet that he's been talking to is, the film is about Ghibli in the sense that Miyazaki's the boy, the granduncle is Takahata, and Suzuki is the heron. Which I just make is a big raspberry for me. Self-insert. Because, you know, Miyazaki's not giving any of these interviews, so Suzuki can say whatever the hell he wants. And, you know, I
can't
wonder,
tell if it's like a self-deprecating, like, I'm just the goofy guy that, like, goes around and heralds people through, or if he's trying to say something else with it. I don't fully understand that.
I think he's looking for a way to make himself the title character.
Not just the title calligrapher. But I think as well, Suzuki, like, again, it speaks to how in our film discourse, often films are just boiled down into one reading and one way of looking at it. And Suzuki probably means that in a way that there are probably elements of Miyazaki's relationship with Takahata, with the granduncle, the way that Takahata was very much an inspiring mentor-like figure for Miyazaki, but then they drifted apart in later years. Takahata very much isolated himself literally in a separate studio of his own making, working on these not vanity projects, but experimental projects that required a lot of resource and time and was separate from the real world in many ways. And yet Suzuki, it made me think of, was it Goro? We interviewed Goro on the podcast when Earwig and the Witch came out, and he referred to Suzuki as a dark wizard who makes me to do things that I don't want to do. And I suppose in The Heron, inviting Mihito into this fantasy world, there is an element of that, and probably... maybe Suzuki's referring to elements of the design of the character that Miyazaki may have drawn. But it's a very pat reading that I think does the film a disservice to have that in your brain as you go and sit down and
I think it's nice, but I don't think it works once you get to the end of the film because their lives are so different, and I don't think the Takahata legacy is so tied to Ghibli or Miyazaki in that way from a global fan perspective as well. As much as we love Takahata's works, I don't think the kind of mourning for his tower crumbling would create as much of an outpouring as it would for Miyazaki and the end of Ghibli.
I would really love to, again, well, maybe this will come out as more material comes out about the film and the production, but it happens right in between, while Miyazaki's working on like parts C, D and E is when Takahata dies. So there is this shift as we go through the film, and a change of direction, or at least a sort of a homing in on certain themes. And maybe the death of a mentor might have informed that in some way, but it's not as easy as, yeah, as easy as it seems in that reading, I don't think.
Well, I think we solved it. I'm joking. Of course. We have not seen this with a dub yet, and who knows what we might understand once we've heard Robert Pattinson.
I did see the great post someone made online about how never before has a character seemingly been created for the voice actor that would play them in the dub as the Parakeet King, looking almost exactly like Dave Bautista in a parakeet outfit. But yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to see the dub. Mm. And also see it in IMAX.
Mm.
Pretty exciting to see. Just drown in the details of the film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if anyone's listening to this who happens to be in London and wants to see it in IMAX, we will be doing a little intro to one on the 6th of January. If anyone wants to come down and say hello, we'd love to see you there. But yeah, that's going to be a real sight to see it big like that. Oh, amazing. Well, I think that kind of draws us to a close on this conversation, which feels like we've only really still scratched the surface of, and I'm sure we'll be coming back for more Boy and the Heron chat. We've got the dub chat to have. We've got a mailbag to have. So make sure you email us your thoughts on the film, ghibliatech@gmail.com. We're going to have a great time, because I'm sure there's going to be so many readings out there that we would have had no idea about, that I'm sure our lovely listeners would have considered.
Absolutely. But until next time, you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter/X. I'm still calling it Twitter, guys. As Ghibliatech. We're on Instagram, ghibliatech.pod. We're also all on the socials individually as well. Jake's on Twitter, Jake H. Cunningham. Instagram, jake.h.cunningham.
Steph's on Twitter @_StephWatts.
Michael's on Twitter @MichaelJLeader. And on Instagram @Michael.Leader. Ghibliatech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.